Session number 833.
Colonel Bain, Real One. Could you start off by telling me a little about your pre-service experiences? What part of the country were you born and brought up in?
Well, I was born in North Wales, and my father was a farmer, and he had a farm in North Wales, not very far from Ruthin. And shortly after I was born, he bought another farm and went over to this new farm in Cheshire, not very far from Tarpley, where nearly all my forebears came from. He farmed there for a period of, I think it was about a year or 18 months, when very tragically he died of a duodenal ulcer, because in those days no one knew what a duodenal ulcer was. And my mother then had to move, sell the farm and move, and she moved to a little place called Coles Hill, which is just above Amersham, where we arrived in 1911, which was a very hot year, just like the year we'd just gone through. And after that, after being there a short time, she was searching round for a house, and she found a very nice house close by Chalfont St Giles, called Nightingales, which belonged to two old ladies who wanted to let it, and my mother rented it, and we were there right up to 1925, which was a period of about 12 or 13 years. And during the First World War, from there, my mother used to take us down to the Lizard in Cornwall, where she had a bungalow. And we lived down there, and as a small boy, went to a private school, a prep school, which was at Northall Place, Potter's Bar. And during the war, because it was considered very dangerous due to the bombing of the aircraft and that kind of thing, and what finally fixed it, I think, was when the Potter's Bar Zeppelin was brought down, and we saw it from, we had a perfect view of the aircraft, this Zeppelin being brought down by Robinson. And so we were moved down to Westgate-on-Sea, where I completed my private school tuition, and moved afterwards to Harrow-on-the-Hill, Harrow School, where I was for a period of about 3.5 years. And it was after that that I decided that I would very much like to farm, and my mother was very keen that I should farm, my father and my grandfather having been farmers also. But the year 1926 came about when the general strike was on. There was no future in farming at that time at all. And so I had to change my views on what my future career would be. And I went to see an uncle of mine who was commanding the 1st Black Watch in Perth, to ask him what he thought about joining the army. So he very strongly advised me to try and get a commission in the Royal Tank Corps, which was obviously the coming thing in those days, in 1926.
What kind of terms did he make that recommendation in, do you recall?
As far as I can remember, he said, well, my sons are going into the Black Watch, and my first cousin went into the Black Watch. But the younger son, he advised to go into the Royal Flying Corps, the RAF, I think it was then, just become RAF, which he did. And he advised me very strongly that if I had no connections with a regiment such as the Black Watch or a county regiment, to go for the Royal Tank Corps, because he said he was quite convinced that the future of the army lay in tanks. And so, being keen on mechanics and that kind of thing, I thought it was a very good idea. And being the age I was, the only thing I could do then was to join the supplementary reserve, and which I did, and apply for an attachment to a regiment of the Royal Tank Corps and see how I liked it. This I did, and I was posted to the 3rd Battalion at Lydd in 1926, August. And I liked it very much. I thought it was a grand life. The people in it were extremely nice, especially the younger ones. The older ones I didn't get on with quite so well, but that was only natural, being a youngster of 19.
Was that, do you think, purely due to the age gap, or were there any other factors?
Certain ones were exceptionally nice, but certain of the others were... Well, I wouldn't have said they were really up to the standard of an officer. But those were very few, and they didn't last very long after I joined.
What kind of things in their behaviour made you come to that conclusion?
Well, they weren't really very keen on the army. Put it that way. They weren't very keen on the army. They had, I think, they were always looking over their shoulder as to whether they could get a good job in civilian life. Because being the age they were, and being how that they would have to retire involuntarily, that I think that's what really caused them not to put their heart and soul into the job into which they were doing. But they weren't the majority. They were the minority in the regiment.
Did you think that the Tank Corps had rather more than its share of those kind of people?
I would have thought so. Yes, I would have thought they did, at that time in 1926. Because it was just after the First World War, and I think that I knew that they'd stayed on. And as I say, it was at that time when we were getting direct intakes from Sandhurst, and the officers coming in were absolutely superb, the young officers.
As regard these older officers, was their influence particularly damaged in any kinds of ways that struck you?
I don't think so, no. I don't think they did, because they really had very little say in the matter.
Yes.
They were second in commands of companies, that's really what they were. After all, as you probably know, they were companies and sections in those days, not squadrons and troops as they are now.
This period while you were still on the supplementary reserve, I suppose it was unusual for a young officer to be sent straight to a battalion. I mean, in the sense that any regular commissioned officer would have gone initially to Bovington for some sort of induction course. As you didn't have that conventional entrance into the Corps, I wondered, when you did get to the battalion, whether you were given any kind of formal or systematic sort of training?
No, not systematic. I became second in command of a section. My section commander treated me not perfectly normally as a normal second lieutenant who had come in the orthodox way. And I found that I didn't feel out of it in any way or at a disadvantage to, as opposed to the people who'd come in by Sandhurst. It wasn't until later, after I'd done this initial attachment, as it was called, that I really was put through the hoop, so to speak, and taught how to become a fully-fledged second lieutenant, but I never felt it was in any way detrimental to my ability. And as I say, I had a very interesting attachment going on manoeuvres to Dover with my section, and we were there for, I suppose, a month or two, and the attachment lasted, as far as I can remember, about 4 months.
Mm. Nonetheless, although you may not have felt at any disadvantage, you came to the battalion not actually knowing anything about how to be a battalion subaltern, and I just wondered what the practical stages of sort of absorbing you into the battalion were.
Well, I, of course, during the winter we did individual training, and we went on tactical exercises without troops. We were taught various parts of the engine of the tank and how the guns worked and all the rest, and I very soon absorbed it because I've always had a fairly good mechanical bent, and I did understand the internal workings of an engine and so forth and so on. But I never felt any disadvantage at all. Mm. But of course, I had to be very careful in trying to absorb all I could and all I knew. But I was not at that time an integral part of the 3rd Battalion of the Royal Tank Corps. I was an attached officer, and as I say, all the young officers and the CO and the second in command of the battalion were exceptionally nice to me, and I got on very, very well indeed. Mm. So much so that when I joined as a regular officer in 1928, I was sent straight back to the 3rd Battalion, where I'd done my attachments.
During this initial period, 26 to 28, how well was the 3rd Battalion equipped? What kind of machines did it have?
The 3rd Battalion was equipped with Vickers medium tanks, and we had quite a good collection of them. But the light section, which I was, 7th section of C Company, was equipped with one Vickers medium tank, which was the command tank, that was the section leader's tank. And we had 7 Carden Lloyds, which were horrible little open things, little open vehicles with tin plate. I don't think the armour was armoured plate at all. It was just ordinary tin plate because the engine of the tank, of these little vehicles, couldn't possibly have carried the weight of armour plating. And they were completely open. They had no cover over them at all, so that if they turned over, you were very apt to be decapitated. And they were powered by a Ford, T model Ford engine, which was dropped into position and connected up, and was driven by the person sitting on the right, and the other person, there were only 2-seaters, sat on his left on the other side of the vehicle, of the engine, and they were most uncomfortable, and the engines were anything but reliable. We had constant trouble with them. But they gave the idea of light tanks moving across country.
You mentioned the vulnerability of the people in the light tanks if the thing turned over, because there was sort of no overhead protection. Was that a theoretical vulnerability, or were there, in fact, accidents with them?
I never knew of one. I never knew of one going completely over. We had them tip up on the side, and they caused rather nasty burns through hot water coming out of the radiator, which was not very far from one's neck. But I never heard of a fatal accident.
Would I be right in assuming that the light tank component of the battalion, its purpose was to act as the sort of reconnaissance group for the
Yes,
battalion?
You're quite right. Mm. Yes. You see, in those days we had no armoured cars. The only armoured cars we had were out in India. And we had no armoured cars at all in this country. But, of course, the tank corps in those days was responsible for manning armoured cars, as we were in India. But it was the idea that the as a battalion moved forward, an armoured battalion moved forward, you had a reconnaissance screen in front, which comprised these light sections of the companies. There was a light section in each company, and one of those was chosen to do the reconnaissance in front of your battalion when it was on the move.
From your practical experience, how well did the Cardon Lloyds seem able to fulfill this reconnaissance role?
Well, of course they couldn't. They were only stand-ins for the proper thing, you see. It was never considered for a moment that these Cardon Lloyds, if we'd gone to war, would have been the reconnaissance vehicle. To give you an idea as to what they looked like, of course you could see them in the tank museum.
I've seen photographs of them.
Yes, but to give you an idea, they were very much like the Bren gun carrier, but much smaller.
Yeah. Yes, I see. The command tank, you said, was a Vickers medium. Did it have any communication equipment for coordinating the...
Oh, yes. We had wireless sets in those days. We had a wireless set, and of course we also had, as far as I can remember, we had a helio set for when the sun was shining, we could flash, but it was chiefly wireless telegraphy, not speaking, it was chiefly done by, yes, I think we did speak, yes, I think we had a transmitter on which we could speak.
How satisfactory was the wireless equipment from the point of view of controlling the company as a whole?
Oh, it was quite efficient. It was quite efficient. But of course you must remember that in those days it was very seldom that a subunit was sufficiently far away from the battalion commander as to be out of sight. We were all very close to one another. I can't quite remember, but whether this was due to the fact that the training area was so small we couldn't expand at all or extend, I can't quite remember that. But it is my opinion that we were always fairly close, say within about 500 yards of the battalion commander's tank.
Did the command tank radio both receive and transmit?
Yes, we did, yes.
And transmit to the Cardon Lloyds?
Oh, no, we had nothing in the Cardon Lloyds. Yes. That was entirely done by flag signal.
So it was really a means of receiving information from the battalion commander?
That's right.
Rather than transmitting it to...
Yes.
Yes, I see. Mm-hmm. Yes. Fine. During the years 26 to 28, when you were still on the supplementary reserve, what was the routine for the individual training during that period?
What do you mean during the year? It's difficult for me to say because you see I was only on attachment from about August until the beginning of the end of November, I think it was, beginning of December in 26, and then I left the army and went to improve my knowledge on military matters at the at a crammer's at Heath End, which is quite close to Aldershot. So I can't really tell you, but I think it was pretty well what took place after I joined the 3rd Battalion in 1929. And we did individual training all through the winter. And during the summer, we came down, when we left Lydd by road with the light tanks and the Cardon Lloyds, and went down to Lulworth to do our annual firing. And then from Lulworth we went up to Salisbury Plain and joined the 1st Tank Brigade for brigade training.
But the individual training at Lydd, where did it take place? Where was your training ground? And
we had no training ground at all. It took place entirely on the square, which we used to do drill and that kind of thing, in classrooms, which we had, for learning various bits about the engine of the tank or the gunnery part of the tank. And, of course, we did many tactical exercises without troops across farmland on the Romney Marsh and all round there. And also, as I told you before, we had 6 horses attached to us. And the officers were very fortunate in that they were able to ride these horses and hire some also from Shorncliffe, from the carbineers. And so we usually, during the whole of the winter, we usually had about 20 or 30 horses in stables. And we used to take some of the senior NCOs out with us as well. And I've always said that this was the best form of training for officers and tank commanders for moving across country and for learning what sort of country it was, whether it was boggy or whether it was hard going or whether there were various ditches and so forth which a tank couldn't get over.
You mentioned tactical exercises. As far as the battalion training was concerned, what was the focus of the tactical exercises?
Well, it was nearly always the same thing, that the enemy was contained and the tanks, the tank force, was used to outflank the enemy, get round the back and destroy all the lines of communications and so bring his army to their knees. That was very briefly the sort of idea behind all these tactical exercises.
That's interesting, because it suggests that the training was related to the function of tanks in an independent capacity as opposed to cavalry support or infantry support or whatever.
Yes, it was. We did do a certain amount of infantry tank cooperation, but as a rule then, as far as I can remember in those days, it was the infantry were very keen on making the tanks, turning the tanks really into mobile guns, which was not really our role. And their idea was to let the tanks move forward and take up tactical positions, hull down. I don't know if you know what hull down means, but it means that the hull of your tank is concealed by a hill or some other form of cover, so that your turret was just showing over the top, so that you could shoot. And having put the tanks into the positions, then the infantry moved forward. And so moved forward again in bounds, like that. Mm.
But your impression is that the battalion training at Lydd was concentrating more on the independent use.
Oh, yes, very much so, because the 3rd Battalion was an integral part of the 1st Tank Brigade, and its main role was this individual role of a tank brigade moving as a tank unit and outflanking the enemy and really operating as a tank unit rather than a tanks and infantry cooperation or any of that kind of thing. There were other battalions which were trained as for infantry tank cooperation. As far as I can remember, the 4th Battalion was for one. But I think as far as I can remember, it was the 2nd, the 3rd, and the 5th Battalion, which were the 1st Tank Brigade on the plain when we used to go and join in manoeuvres.
Did you ever use the beach at Lydd for training exercises?
Well, as I told you before, they did try once, and the first thing that happened was all the pebbles caught up in the tracks, and the tracks burst within about 100 yards of starting to go across there. But it was the original intention that's why Lydd was chosen, because they thought these miles of shingle where no farmland was involved and that would be ideal for tank training and a certain amount of tactical training with the vehicles. But this was not to be, and it was absolutely impossible. And we never, never took the tanks on the shingle at all.
That says something for the knowledge of the higher army command in making decisions about the placement of battalions, doesn't it?
Well, I think it did, yes, I think it did. But that was the answer. You see, all the regiments, they had very little training area. The one that I suppose had the most was our 2nd Battalion at Farnborough, because they could go out on the common land behind Farnborough and train. But the 4th Battalion at Catterick, it was absolutely hopeless. We had virtually no training area at all there. The 5th Battalion, it was fairly lucky, at Perham Down. But there again, on Salisbury Plain in the winter, we had to be very, very careful, because we could never go over any of the racing tracks. That was horse racing tracks that were the training gallops, because if we did, we were never allowed anywhere near the area again. Mm. And we had to be terribly careful, and it did rather become a farce after a time with all these various restrictions and that kind of thing.
Given the concept of the tank as a highly mobile arm, did you find the lack of appropriate areas for battalion training much of an obstacle and handicap?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And that is why I keep on referring back to the horses that we had, and had it not been for those, I dread to think what would have happened when the war started in 1939, mm-hmm. because I don't think really that any of the regimental commanders or the company commanders or squadron commanders could possibly have, well, carried out their role as indeed they did.
And the annual training exercises, usually on Salisbury Plain, didn't really compensate for
I don't for think so, no, because the vehicles, you see, you must remember that in the early days, the vehicles were terribly unreliable. And although we had a wonderful collection of fitters, we had our own workshops, you see. It wasn't run by the REMI. It was RAOC, actually, the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, who ran the workshops. But we had our own fitters. And they were absolutely amazing how they kept those tanks going. But the various drive and epicyclics and the clutches and that kind of thing were constantly going wrong. Mm-hmm. And probably put the one tank that you were relying on out of action for perhaps 3 days.
At the end of this period of supplementary reserve status, by what means did you eventually get a regular commission?
I went for an interview with General Ironside, who was at that time commanding Aldershot District, and a very frightening affair, as you can well imagine. And I was interviewed by General Ironside. I suppose the interview took something like 3/4 of an hour or an hour. And he went into all my background history and everything else and this, that and the other. And I told him that my uncle was commanding the Black Watch at Borden at that time. And he happened to know him, and I think that probably helped a bit, but he went very thoroughly into it all, and then after that I had to take an exam, which I can't remember where it was. I think it was at Sandhurst that I, or so it may have been Aldershot District that I took this exam. It didn't amount to a great deal, but anyway, I managed to pass it, and the next thing I knew was that I got a letter from the War Office to say that I'd been accepted as a regular officer in the Royal Tank Corps.